Blog Talk Radio.
Dallas, Texas, on Sunday, June 25th. As we like to do on Sundays, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We have a whole yellow pad of things that we're going to get into tonight. One of the big stories, of course, the Democrats in Georgia. But it wasn't just the Democrats who went wrong that night. I think the news media has little answering to do. The pollsters have a little answering to do. And, of course, Mrs. Pelosi, her future is hanging on this. So a lot about the Democrats tonight. The land of Lincoln is not doing very well. A lot of financial problems, and they just can't seem to figure it out. And I don't know what they're going to do. It's a real problem in Chicago and Illinois and the land of Lincoln. It's hard to think that one of the most amazing states in American history would be having these problems. But they've had a lot of bad leadership, I think, over the years. Obamacare is now with the GOP in the Senate. They're having some differences, but I think they'll figure it out. It's in their interest to get this done, obviously. Something has happened to the Russian story. For months, we've been hearing about collusion between President Trump and his staff with Russia. Now, all of a sudden, I think the story is changing a little bit. And the question we're asking right now is, what did President Obama knew about this, and why didn't he do something about it? I think that's a very legitimate question, and I think it may very well twist this issue altogether. It may prove to be something the Democrats really didn't want to be talking about, something else related to President Obama. It appears that his attorney general, Ms. Lynch, is going to be explaining a few things to the Senate. So these scandals associated with Trump could be flipping a little bit here on the Democrats. North Korea, the death of an American citizen, something has to be done. We just can't accept that type of treatment of U.S. citizens across the country. The Middle East, always problems in the Middle East. And we may have a new Supreme Court justice this summer, at least a battle for a Supreme Court justice. And frankly, I'm not looking forward to it because it gets extremely crazy every time we have one of those. Let me say hello to our friend Bill Katz, editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, it's warm, humid Texas weather, but we're ready for a good interview with you tonight, Bill.
Well, I'm ready, too. It's actually a very nice day here in New York. We have been blessed with good weather in the last few days. I think Al Gore has gone home. There was a sighting of him on the road with his 12-cylinder car, with a sign on it saying, "I'm minimizing my carbon footprint." But he has gone home to one of his mansions, and things look good for this week.
Yeah, it was actually a very pretty – I knew that it was a pretty week in New York, Bill, because the Rangers, our baseball team, was playing the Yankees this weekend. And so we had a chance to see what the weather was like there. And it was raining Friday night, but it was very pretty Saturday and Sunday. Well, we have a lot to get into.
No, I was saying we took a trip yesterday up to Hyde Park to President Roosevelt's home, the last time I visited there was about 30 years ago. And it's always a good trip, no matter what your politics, it's always a good trip. You learn a great deal. And I'm always amazed at how well the National Park Service runs these sites. We've been to several of them, the Antietam. The guides are very good, very knowledgeable, and it's something I recommend listeners to do, to go to the National Historic Sites of the United States, because they really are quite an education.
Yeah, there's quite a few. If you take, for example, I took a trip a couple of years ago. We went to see our son when he was doing his service, military service, and he was in Alabama. So we took a trip from Texas to Alabama, and we took I-10, which sort of crosses the whole country. And there's a lot of Civil War places that, or places you can stop and learn about the Civil War, many of these places like monuments and so on that you're talking about. And you're right. I always hope we keep this, Bill, because 50 years from now, 100 years from now, that's how people really learn their history. I mean, obviously they study it, but there's nothing like walking into a museum like Hyde Park or whatever, or George Washington's home, Mount Vernon in Virginia, that I had the pleasure of visiting years ago. You learn so much. You feel so much a part of the country's history, Bill, when you walk into these places, Bill.
That's right. And sometimes you can actually go to where history was made. I remember one of the most moving days we ever had was visiting Antietam, one of the great Civil War battles. And it was all fought on one day, and you can actually stand in the very places where troops fought. And it gives you a very eerie feeling.
Yeah, well, last summer when we went to New York, we did spend an afternoon in Gettysburg.
Yes.
I mean, the beauty of the East Coast is that these things are not that far.
No. They were all laid out in the days before automobiles.
Exactly. So you can go from Baltimore to Gettysburg in a couple of hours, not even that long.
That's right.
You can have a one-day trip and still come home and have a good time. But Gettysburg is a fantastic place to visit as well. Just a quick thing, just a couple of quick things, Bill. I just wanted to mention that on this day, June 25th, a couple of big things that happened in the 20th century. In 1942, General Eisenhower became the commander of the Allied troops. And in 1950, the Korean War began. So these are two things that President Truman and President Eisenhower had to deal with, two big events of the 20th century, Bill.
That's exactly right. And on the second, June 25th, very, very important because it was the day that the North Koreans invaded South Korea with great help from the Soviet Union and material help and strategic help. And the response by President Truman was one of the great responses of any president in American history to a foreign act, and that is he recognized immediately how serious this was, and he went to the UN, and the Russians, ironically, were boycotting the Security Council that week for some reason, and we were able to get through what was called a Uniting for Peace resolution, we committed our troops, other nations committed theirs, but it was mostly American troops and South Korean troops. But it was the first time in human history that aggression was repelled by an international organization. And despite great difficulties during the Korean War and bitter fighting and bitter casualties, we prevailed. And that is why there is a South Korea today. And isn't it ironic that we're still talking about the problems with North Korea this many, many decades later?
Absolutely. I was just thinking the same thing. I mean, here we have North Korea once again causing a lot of problems. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. And Dwight Eisenhower becoming the commander of the Allies, that was only 11 years before he became president of the United States. I don't know if there's ever been someone who has gone up that quickly, Bill, from being a very unknown person to becoming president. I guess you could say that about Barack Obama.
Oh, yes,
that was
very much
that
so.
That was a unique yeah.
He was unknown the day before he became president.
That's true.
We have had others, but the fact of the matter is what was remarkable about Eisenhower was not so much his rise to the presidency, because he had been, after all, a very famous general, but his rise to becoming a general. I mean, he had been before World War II a lieutenant colonel, a mid-grade field grade officer, and mid-level field grade officer, and he was one of the men listed in George Marshall's little black book, George Marshall being the Army Chief of Staff, who kept a little black book of officers he thought were outstanding and who would lead if there were a new war. And Eisenhower was very much at the top of that list, and he just went right up the ranks from lieutenant colonel, ending World War II as a five-star general, and, of course, commanded our forces in Europe and was really the architect, one of the architects, probably the chief architect, of the liberation of Europe, negotiated with Stalin, with de Gaulle, with Churchill, with his own president, Franklin Roosevelt. Later, of course, was elected President of the United States in 1952. What's interesting about that is if you compare his background and his experience with that of somebody like, for example, Barack Obama, there's no comparison. I mean, Eisenhower was one of those people with a very, very heavy resume, and it was filled with accomplishment and service. And I just wish we had those days again. I really do. I remember the days when you looked at the people running for president in each individual party. They were people of considerable stature. They really were.
Right. Well, you wonder how much television has had to do with that.
Yes.
Because Eisenhower, most people, you know, he was not a television president. In fact, it wasn't really until, I think, his second term that he even had a press conference. And then I think it was Kennedy who had the first televised press conference. But those were, I guess, days, what I like to say, more the days of paper, where you have to be more substantial in a paper than you do on television. And I think maybe that has something to do with it. Well, it was an amazing week, Bill, for the Democrats and for everybody, really, in this election in Georgia. And I say so because everybody, I mean, I sat down Tuesday night thinking that the Democrats, I never thought they were going to win, but I thought it was going to be very, very close. And in fact, there was even the polls were saying that it was going to be very close, and that but they were trending in the Democrats' direction, and it was supposed to be a referendum on President Trump. And by 9:30, 10 o'clock Central Time, Bill, the whole darn thing was over, and she was delivering a victory speech. And it ended up being 52-48. That's not a landslide, but it's a, you know, it's a fair victory. And the pollsters got it wrong. The Democrats got it wrong. I think there's a little explaining to do, as Ricky Ricardo would say, Bill.
Yes, and I think, the as you said before, the explaining has to be across the board. The political pundits, the news reporters, the pollsters. I think it's perfectly evident now that the polling in the last year has been defective, because there has been a, I don't think it was a conspiracy in any way, but a tendency to underpoll the Trump voters, the people who support Donald Trump. And that underpolling has thrown off a number of polls. Now, Handel, who won the congressional race, was not a deep supporter of Trump, but she brought out the Trump supporters. I think the most stunning thing about this race was not that the Republican won. It is a Republican district. But the fact that the Republican base came out in such massive numbers. There was a belief that it may not happen because in the primary contest for the nomination, there were about, 19 Republicans running. And the feeling was that no matter who came out on top, that individual would not have great support. There wouldn't be great enthusiasm. The party was split, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the fact is, on Election Day, the Republicans came out in droves, and that's what gave her that election victory. True, it was not a landslide, as you pointed out, but for someone who was behind during a good part of the race and someone who was expected to possibly lose, the result was a stunning surprise. And it as many commentators pointed out, it meant that in the last four special elections that have occurred since Donald Trump's election last year as president, the Democrats haven't won one of those races, despite all kinds of predictions that they were going to create miracles.
That's right, and in the there was also the one in Montana, was it, or Wyoming?
Yeah.
The one where the fellow
Montana.
Hit the reporter. Yeah, where the fellow hit the
reporter. That was Montana as well.
Yeah,
I think it was
one of the western states, but it seems to me what. With the pollsters, that to me is more of a technical problem. I don't think it's so much ideology, because at the end of the day, the pollsters get paid for being right. I mean, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, you want to come up with the right answer because you want to get hired for the next election. And I think that what's happening is that it's becoming very, very difficult to take these polls when so many people don't answer their phone lines anymore. And if they have a landline and they see who's calling, they don't answer. So I think that's part of the problem. It's a technical problem. I think the pollsters are going to have to find out some other way of getting the information, Bill. Maybe it's online. Maybe there's a way to do it. I don't know how to do it. But the traditional calling people on the phone is not generating the kind of credibility that it once did, Bill.
That's correct. And also the conventional wisdom, if you want to call it that, that we get every time there's an election campaign seems to be failing. The usual belief is that once a president is elected, the opposition party starts making gains against that president. People forget, for example, that even in the year after Pearl Harbor, where there was such passion in the country, a patriotic feeling, the following November, President Roosevelt lost an enormous amount of support in Congress. The Republicans gained. That was the traditional response. Here, it doesn't look as if the Democrats are doing all that well. And I think one congressman, it was a Tim Ryan of Ohio, who said that our brand is toxic. And he's right. Just because President Trump is not wildly popular does not mean the American people will turn to the Democratic Party. As a nation, they seem to dislike the Democratic Party quite a bit, and for very good reasons.
Right. I think it's interesting, too, and we have now seen that. You can go back to maybe 1980, that the Republicans turn out to vote, maybe with the exception of 2006 when Bush lost the Congress. A lot of it was just because of Iraq. But if you look at most of the other elections, maybe 2008 also, but if you look at most of the other elections, Republicans are turning out. And when they fear that the Democrats are going to win, they turn out even greater. I think that's what happened in Georgia. A lot of Republicans said, no, there's no way we're going to lose this thing, and I'm going to vote for this lady even if I don't like her, because we don't want to lose. And that's something the Democrats have to fear going forward, particularly to 2018, when they have so many Senate seats in play. They're going to have to fear that the Democrats or that the Republicans are turning out. I'm not sure the Democrats are that excited about their party bill.
I don't think they are, and yet when you go and look into the internals of some of these polls and examine the party itself, the reason they're not excited may be the wrong reasons. there seems to be a lot of belief in the Democratic Party that if it went even further to the left, it would then ignite some great public passion that is supposedly there. I have not seen this public passion except on the faces of some leading Democrats and some fellow travelers, but it doesn't seem to be there among the real voters.
No. No, I think they've got all the liberals are going to get right now, though.
Yes.
I think I would even go further. It's not really liberals, because we're not really talking about liberals, as you've explained many times on the show. We're really talking here about people in the left, like Tom Perez, for example. That's what we're talking about. And I think the Democrats have all of those already. There aren't any people like that hiding in a closet or in a cave somewhere that are going to magically come out. They've got them all, but they're just not enough, Bill, to win the election.
That's right. And also, there has been a behavior problem in the Democratic Party that many reporters simply don't want to acknowledge. They don't even want to deal with the subject. But you have a national chairman who's a hard leftist and who uses foul language in speeches in front of children. You have a head of a Democratic Party in California, our largest state, who does the same thing, got up at their state convention and used filthy language. You have a Democratic senator from California, Kamala Harris, who now is trying to become a movie star or something, has had to be silenced twice in committee hearings recently in the Senate because her behavior was so bad, who gets up and also seems to feel that the use of certain words will help the party. I don't know who she's appealing to, maybe to 15-year-olds. And then you have our senator here in New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, presumably an educated woman, went to Dartmouth. Her roommate was Connie Britton, the actress. And then went on to law school. And she also, on several occasions, you know, if they do it once and it slips out, all right, you can forgive them. But on several occasions, it's a pattern, uses the F word to make points to public audiences. We have never had that before. And yet nobody in the press wants to discuss it. As if it's, well, it's okay. It's her narrative. It's her way of speaking. Well, let her speak that way, you know, to a family audience, and let her see the reaction she gets. I don't know who they are trying to attract.
Well, they don't, I don't think they know either, Bill. I think that's part of the problem. I think they're totally confused, and that brings us to Mrs. Pelosi, who may very well be on her way out. I don't see Now, some people think that she wants to stick around because she's got hopes of being the speaker in a couple of years, and I suppose that could happen. But I'm beginning to think that it's less likely to happen, Bill, with just what we've seen here in the last few weeks.
I think that's true. I think, by the way, she not only has hopes of being the Speaker of the House, I think she has hopes that go beyond that. I really believe that some of these Democrats think that President Trump is going to be impeached and removed, and that Vice President Pence is going to be impeached and removed, and that whoever is Speaker of the House, being third in line, will become president. And I think she probably, in her dreams, has believed that this is going to happen on her watch, and that magically, the Democrats will take control of the House. She will become Speaker again. They will remind her of where the building is, and these other two will be knocked down after some great impeachment action, and Nancy will be President Nancy. I would not put that past her to think that way.
No, I these people are really nutty. I mean, when you listen to them, they're just completely nutty. But at least for the time being, they're completely disconnected from the rest of the country, and I don't see any signs out there that they're going to connect anytime soon. Bill, let's take a little break, and when we come back, I want to talk about the land of Lincoln. I want to talk about Obamacare and lots of other things. Russia, quite a lot to get into with our friend Bill tonight. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and let's get back to our conversation with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, before we talk about Illinois and the land of Lincoln, I just wanted to make a quick story. You know, as you know, our family lived in Wisconsin in the late 60s and so on when we lived up there. And one of the real treats for me was to go down to Chicago with my parents. And I was always so fascinated with that city, and my parents would always talk about how well and how elegant and well-run that city was. And there was a sense that this is a city that was really going well. I don't think there's that sense today. So it's kind of sad to see what's happened to the city and the state. I mean, they're on the brink of bankruptcy, and nobody has any clues of what's going to happen, Bill. Hello? Did I lose Bill?
No, I think I'm back.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry for a minute.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Were you able to hear me? I was talking about...
Yes, I heard you, and then for some reason...
Oh, okay, great.
The phone faded out.
It was Al Gore who did that. Was Al Gore. He's mad at the joke you cracked about him at the start of the show.
That's probably true, and he feels I'm using too much electricity or something.
That's it.
As I was saying, I went to the University of Chicago, so of course I know Chicago well and love Chicago, always enjoyed being there. But in recent years, the city has really stumbled badly. Now, part of that is a legacy of an appearance of being well-run. There is no question that the Daley machine, in many respects, did a pretty good job of running Chicago, at least on the surface. It was a clean city. It was a city that people liked to visit. You know, it had the great hotels and all the rest. Under the surface, the reality was probably somewhat different, in that the school system was allowed to run down. The police force was not up to snuff, and there were regular reports of corruption. So under it, even under the Daley administration, which was widely admired, there were problems that were developing. The trouble is these problems were never fixed. And the trouble also is that Chicago became a city where politics, and we have seen this so many times, began to be based almost entirely on race. And this is something that Rudy Giuliani was able to avoid in New York City when he decided that the crime problem had to be confronted and solved. Instead of going to all the community leaders and getting their assent and getting their participation, he, in effect, said, I am the mayor, it's my responsibility, and I'm going to get it done. And he got it done. The crime rate in New York went down 80% under the Giuliani and then Bloomberg administrations in New York. And one of the reasons was they actually addressed the problem. They didn't address the politics of the problem. And what you see in Chicago, of course, is entirely the opposite. You have the influence of local leaders who just don't seem to ever get anything done. You have the influence of racially charged groups. You have a mayor, Rahm Emanuel, who's actually a very capable man, but there's very little he can do in the face of some of these very extreme groups. And he didn't understand how Giuliani made it work in New York. Giuliani made it work by solving the problem. You have a city in Chicago where problems have to be solved with the cooperation of every little constituency, and it isn't going to happen. And, of course, what you also have is a city that began to develop, perhaps more than any other in America, the entitlement mentality, which is a mentality also, by the way, that dominated New York City in the 1960s. This business of gimme, 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 I want this benefit, I want that benefit, I want my group represented in this school and in that school. You can't run a city that way. And what you have is a city that now has a financial base that cannot support the city. The city, in turn, is corrupting the state financially. Illinois is doing very, very poorly, but compare, please, to the states around Illinois that are doing well. Indiana is doing well. Wisconsin under Scott Walker is doing well. Let's not forget that Indiana was the state that Mike Pence ran as governor before he became vice president. So that should be noted. Scott Walker, as I said, in Wisconsin. Iowa seems to be doing well. Those states are doing better than Illinois, which is in the center of all of them. And is perhaps the most renowned of all states because it is the land of Lincoln. But the state itself, you pointed out, is on the brink of bankruptcy, and there does not seem to be the sense of urgency in solving the problem that you would think there can be, because Illinoisans have gotten so used to that identity politics, that group politics mentality. Their only interest is will my group get benefits even after bankruptcy? And that is the mentality of the state. If they would just look around them at the states that surround Illinois, they will see a very different picture.
Right. I have a friend up there who tells me that the property taxes are now going to not just to run the state, but to pay for the public sector unions. It's become a real mess. I don't think it's sustainable. I don't have any idea how it's going to work out, but it's not sustainable. Because there's the one thing that states cannot do is print money. So they got to deal with the deficit at some point. My guess is that they will come to the federal government, and then maybe Mr. Trump can demand a few things from them, such as sanctuary cities and some of these other problems that they have. But it's a shame because Chicago is such a great city, at least in the eyes of the world. It was one of the great American cities, one of the great cities of North America, Bill.
That's right. Carl Sandburg wrote poems about Chicago. And, of course, it has been the center of American political history and the national conventions. It has been a great broadcast center. It's where the first televised presidential debates were held. And having gone to the University of Chicago, it's a great center of research in nuclear energy. But the state has come on hard times, and again, there does not seem to be the sense of urgency. They now have a Republican governor, which is a lot better than having a Democratic governor, but there's very little he can do without the support of the legislature, without the support of the tremendous power of Chicago in Illinois politics, and the state may just continue to deteriorate, and what a sad story that is. By the way, it is also the state, as you know, which is the home state of Barack Obama, and he has not said a word. His library
not even
is going to be there.
He's not even living there anymore.
Yes, yeah. And that's where his library is going to be.
Right. And
he doesn't seem to have any interest in it. Maybe he'll visit the library. Maybe he'll even get a library card. I mean, who knows?
That's right.
But he doesn't seem very much interested in it. And you would think he would be. And then, of course, there are all these local big mouths out there, like Jesse Jackson. They don't seem terribly interested in it. And that's part of the sadness here. What they need is an absolute commitment, but what they also may need is some, as you pointed out, is some outside power. If the crime rate in Chicago gets worse, if we have another long hot summer, the tragedy continues, I would not be opposed to President Trump saying to the mayor of Chicago and the governor of Illinois, if you do not solve this problem, I'm going to send federal troops in to patrol the streets. And that may be just the jolt they need.
Right. No, I think something has to happen because, I mean, this is a very sick situation there in Chicago. Well, Obamacare is now with the GOP and the U.S. Senate. They've put out a plan. I know it's not perfect. I understand five senators are not going to vote for it. I still think, Bill, that they're going to get something done because the alternative is worse. Not getting something done is going to be bad for the Republicans. So I think they'll get it done. I think they only, of those five, they got to convince three because they can live with two voting against it. So hopefully they'll get it done. But I think the real sadness to me, Bill, is that not a single Democrat. I'm disappointed with Mr. Manchin, the lady from North Dakota, the guy from Indiana, the lady from Missouri. I'm disappointed with these people because Obamacare is not working in their states. And if they would simply step up and say, I'm going to put my state over the politics, I think that'd be a great sign, Bill.
It would be, and I don't think it's going to happen. You know, we have this old problem of the Democratic Party, the so-called moderate Democrats who run as moderates and go to Washington and become liberals. Claire McCaskill of Missouri, who you mentioned, is one of the prime examples of that. I'm not an expert on healthcare programs, so I don't really have that much to say about it. But there are basic rules at play here that are not necessarily being followed. One rule is if you give a benefit to people, an important benefit, not a frivolous benefit, but an important benefit, you can't take it away from them. And the Republicans have to proceed with great care here. They really do. They have to make sure, first of all, that this health plan does the job in terms of the nation's health. That's the first requirement. The first requirement is not how do you save money. That's obviously very important, but how do you serve the people? And they may fall into a terrible trap because once, if they get a bill through and it is signed by the president, they then own health care. They can no longer say the Democrats did it. They then own it, and they have to make it work. And I'm not so sure they have that ability. They're not the Republican Party right now is not in great shape. It's not a great party of doers. They have had years to come up with a health plan, and they haven't done so.
Right. Well, the problem is that it's very difficult. I think if we're learning anything is that it's very difficult for the federal government to deal with this. And that's why I've always been a believer that what we need to do is just let it collapse, repeal it, and just say to the governors, hey, guys, this is your problem. Deal with it. We'll help you financially. We'll send you money if we have to, but this is now your problem. I actually think we would get better coverage that way, that we would get better plans because the solution would be closer to the people, Bill.
I think that's probably true. And look, there are all kinds of conspiracy theories that float around about health care, one of which was that the Obamacare was so bad it had to be designed intentionally to fail so that then the Democrats could suggest single payer, which, of course, is the European system. And since the Democrats think everything in Europe is better than it is here, that is probably what they favor. It certainly is what Bernie Sanders favors. I don't think we're going to have single payer either. This is going to be a very, very difficult problem. You know, this whole thing began on a lie. The lie was that 40 million Americans were uninsured. The fact is nobody was uninsured. If you wanted health care, even under the old system, you got it. The hospitals were required to give it to you. It wasn't a very elegant system. It needed improvement. But we did not have bodies in the streets. We really didn't. And nobody wanted to look at that. In fact, our national health was pretty good. There were even areas in which we exceeded Europe. For example, in survivability of breast cancer, where we actually were ahead of Europe. What happened was, instead of fixing the problems that needed to be fixed, the Democratic Party, being what it is today, went out and tried to redesign the whole healthcare system. That was not necessary. Sometimes patchwork is the best way of dealing with these things. Also, I think they took the states out of it. I'd like to see far more state participation. The states are great laboratories for getting things done and for developing programs that are tailored to local needs. And the states kind of were taken out of it. Now the Republicans
Absolutely.
Have it. Now the Republicans have it. I don't know if they'll make it work. I try to follow it. It's very hard to follow. But one of the sad things about the coverage of it is that the coverage of it seems to have very little to do with health care and much more to do with the politics of health care, you know, which is the way the kind of news reporting we're getting nowadays. If I pick up a proposal on health care, what I want to know is what is in that proposal that's going to affect my family. I'm not terribly interested in whether a particular senator is making a good statement today. And that's the way the news gets reported today, and it's so frustrating. So we should know within the next week or so whether the Republicans can get it together. But we should also know how this plan impacts the average American. If it impacts the average American badly, the Republican Party will have bought itself a disaster.
That's the problem. That's the problem. They're going to own what the Democrats, the unpopular program they had. And in a sense, they're going to save Obamacare it's one of the great ironies. They would save Obamacare and make it popular by passing something unpopular of their own. But I will say one thing about the states. In California, we just had a very interesting thing happen in California.
Yes.
They were all gung-ho to do universal care. I mean, it was like, we're going to show the country and we're going to show Trump and we're going to show the Republicans that we can do universal health care. Then they did the numbers and they've come to realize that we cannot afford this thing. It's bigger than the whole state budget. So, I thought that was very interesting, Bill.
Well, I thought it was very interesting too. And of course, again, you had these airheads in the California Democratic Party who thought that we could become France overnight. What I think is so striking out there is that people are looking at a problem and not wanting to define it, and that is that the cost of health care is so astronomic, we should be looking at ways at reducing that cost. Now, health care in some cases has gone down in cost. For example, hospital stays today are lower than they ever have been. And the reason was the development of prescription drugs. Prescription drugs have had a tremendous effect on shortening hospital stays. In effect, you get the care at home through a pill rather than through living hands in a hospital. And that has reduced hospital costs substantially in many areas. But we don't seem to try to lower the cost of health care while at the same time maintaining quality in health care. And it seems to me that I don't know why people don't want to look at that. We also should look at shaping health care plans to individuals and to individual organizations and local constituencies. I mean, I've seen health care plans that shortchange, for example, things like eyeglass coverage, which is so important to so many millions of people, but they have all kinds of coverage for every little social problem that you could possibly have. I mean, they will cover gender reassignment. They will cover substance abuse, no matter what substance it is you abuse. Drinks too much water, we'll give them a plan. Too much Pepsi Cola, yep, there's the coverage for that. But then when it comes down to really important things, they skimp on it. And I think people are looking at those plans and saying, you know, what is going on here? Also, age is a very important factor. It may be that the best way of securing coverage for young people up to a certain age will be to begin with catastrophic policies and having a basic health care taken care of through some other type of plan, possibly through work, because most young people don't get sick. It's mostly the health care system is very, very heavily oriented in terms of cost toward older people. So there can be all kinds of systems that we can look at, but I just don't think that the passion is there, and I think there's so much ideology involved in this that it becomes almost an impossible issue to solve.
Right. Well, this is but this is why I think that if you were to send it to the states and involve the states, which I think this plan actually does, much more than Obamacare did, of course, then you would have a fellow like a Governor Pence in Indiana, who could make some changes to his plan or his health care, or Governor Kasich in Ohio, who's done some interesting things too, or here in Texas. I just think that the states would be a better place for this to get fixed. And then, if nothing else, people can get angry at the state reps instead of because I think the state reps are closer to them than the congressional reps or the U.S. senators. But yes, I agree with you. I think we have to try different things. Let me talk a little bit about Russia, Bill, because I mentioned in the introduction, and you talked about this as well at Urgent Agenda, that I think there's a new component to the story here. There's a new character in this story, and that's President Obama. That now we're learning that he knew about this, so either he didn't care about it or he was incompetent. Either way, it doesn't make him look very good, Bill.
No, it doesn't. Finally, the Republican Party woke up to the reality that they had opportunities here to flip this whole thing around. And they have now decided to do it. But the first announcement, as you saw this week, was the announcement that Loretta Lynch's conduct as Attorney General will be looked at, especially in regard to her apparently telling the then FBI Director James Comey to treat the Hillary and Clinton investigation not as an investigation, but as an item. I don't recall the exact word she used, but sort of just a subject. And he felt that she was trying to influence the investigation. You know, it's time. The Republican Party is very lax. It really is. It's very unimaginative. They're a bunch of nice gentlemen and ladies, but they really have to become more aggressive. When you get attacked the way they've been attacked in these investigations, you have to fight back. Now they're fighting back. Now they're demanding, and you have to give a great deal of credit here to Senator Grassley of Iowa, who is the head of the Judiciary Committee. They're now demanding investigations into Loretta Lynch, into the actions toward Russian hacking by the Obama administration or the lack of action. And they are changing, as you said, the orientation. The effect may be to lessen the pressure on President Trump. It may be the Democrats are now seeing that, wait a minute, all these investigations have gotten us nowhere. And you certainly saw the stories this week that many Democratic leaders are asking the Democrats in Congress to lay off Trump a little bit on the Russia thing because nobody's interested. They're not getting anything out of it. And yet we have investigations that continue in that regard. We have the special prosecutor now, Mr. Mueller, who seems obsessed with hiring Democratic Party lawyers to join his staff. And so, still the Democrats insist on these investigations going on and on and on, but maybe some wiser people among them are prevailing or will at least have some influence and say, wait a minute, the American people really want you to do is to come up with an agenda that will help them every day, not just to investigate. So fascinating times coming up.
Yeah, but I actually think that the Democrats may have created a trap here that they fell into because they put so much emphasis on Russia. You know, Russia, the idea of Russia intervening in our elections was the greatest violation of American sovereignty since God knows what. And now we're finding out that it was actually happening. And see, happening under President Obama, Bill, I always thought that this was a great opportunity to go back to President Obama and say, what were you doing? I mean, if in fact the Russians were involved like this, why didn't you do something about it? My explanation, Bill, just my own gut feeling tells me that I think they were so convinced that Hillary Clinton was going to win that they thought, she wins, all of this goes away, we don't have to worry about any of these investigations, and, you know, it'll be home free. Well, obviously that didn't happen, and now they have a lot of investigations to worry about, none more important than Attorney General Lynch. I think she's in for a very difficult visit when she goes to Congress, Bill.
I think she is, too. And, you know, one of the things that happened this week that got ignored, like most of the important stories getting ignored by the press, is that the Congressional Black Caucus refused an invitation by the president to have them visit and meet with them. Now, he did it once before, and they did come. in the time since, he has taken some actions that they haven't liked. Well, that happens in politics. That's why he was elected. And he offered an opportunity to come again, to try to influence the president, talk to the president, and they turned him down. That's something you just don't do. You don't turn down an invitation to have the ear of the president. And I think that the Republicans are looking at this, and they're saying that they cannot get cooperation out of the Congressional Black Caucus. And I think that will make matters worse for Loretta Lynch. I really do. You know, ordinarily, they would tread a little more easily because of the obvious racial issue that is always involved in these things. And I'm not so sure they're going to tread easily. I think the Republicans are angry.
Well, they should be. And I would like to ask one of these members of the Congressional Caucus, the Black Congressional Caucus, I would like to ask one of them, how can they look at their constituents and,
right.
and say to them, we're not going to visit with President Trump. Things are going so well in our districts. You know, our districts are, there's full employment, there's full economic activity, the schools are working well. I mean, their districts are a disaster, each and every one of them. I mean, here in North Texas, Bill, the one district doing terrible is the one Democrat district run by Eddie Bernice Johnson and Black Democrats. It's doing horrible. All you have
That's
to
right.
do is drive through it. I mean, you drive through that district, and it's you feel like you've left the world. You've left the United States, and you've gone into a third world country, Bill.
Yes, and I will throw out a provocative idea. I'm not so sure that bothers the Black leaders. I think in a way that they see that as their power base, that if these people began to make too much progress, they would want new leaders. You know, there's the old story of
right.
political machines, yeah, of political machines in the city, in the big cities. They never wanted their people to make that much progress. They wanted them to give them the little things. You know, oh, yes, oh, Mrs. O'Leary, your daughter wants to be a meter maid. Yes, we can do that for you when she'll get a pension. The little things. But as soon as they get the big things, they're not going to want all these old leaders anymore. They're going to want a new type of leader. So very often, I think leaders stay in power by delivering small services, or favors as they're called in politics, but what they don't want are the big moves, because that disrupts them.
That's right. Well, we're going to take one more break, Bill, and we'll be back, and we'll talk a little bit about North Korea and the possibility of a new Supreme Court justice this summer. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Time always flies when we're chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. We've got a couple of more stories, Bill, I want to get into. One is North Korea, tragedy of this young man who passed away. I mean, I don't know whether we can specifically say or blame North Korea for what happened, but certainly, you know, over the last week or so, I've been angry and wish we could just punch him a little bit and send him a message more than just a nasty statement by the president, Bill.
I agree. I mean, what happened to this young man was just unspeakable, really unspeakable. Apparently, he was an outstanding young man. And I wish we could punch them, too. It is very difficult. You know, Secretary Mattis was one of the best appointments that Trump made. Talked about the possibility of a military confrontation with North Korea, and he cautioned about it. He said it would be horrible, just the casualties. It would be horrible. And as a military man, he knows that. I think they are trying to put as much pressure on North Korea as possible without going to war, but the North Koreans are completely unresponsive. And at some point, there may have to be some physical action, either a blockade or the fire, or you know, shooting down one of their missiles during a test, but something to send a stronger message, because nothing is working.
No, and China, I'm disappointed with China. I thought they might see an opportunity here to get rid of a problem, but I guess maybe it's not a problem for China, Bill.
Well, the president has said in the last week that he didn't get as much action out of China as he wished, and he reflected your disappointment as well. And that's true. You know, we're depending on China to keep North Korea in line, but what if China's real attitude is, well, we'll keep them in line in terms of not going to war, but we're going to make things a little hard for the United States. After all, they see the United States as a competitor.
Well, that may be. Then if that's the case, then I think we're going to have to do something unilaterally, either take out some missiles, figure out some way of minimizing the military damage or the damage to civilians somehow. But this cannot go on like
that's
this.
That's right. Now, it's interesting that the South Koreans recently elected what might be called a peace government, a government more to the left than the one they had previously. And that government has as its goal some type of negotiated settlement with North Korea, even reunification with North Korea. But I found it fascinating that in the last week or so, that government, that peace government, has been talking very toughly to North Korea. And maybe there is now a recognition on its part that if it wants to keep American support, they're going to have to get in line behind a policy that is more confrontational with North Korea. It is probably the biggest tinderbox in the world right now, even bigger than some of the ones in the Middle East, because North Korea is not a weak country. It's a poor country, but it's not a weak country. They have nuclear weapons. We don't know exactly how many they have. It's not that many, but you know, two or three can do a lot of damage. They have a very active missile program. They are exporting their technology, presumably to Iran, and they seem very indifferent to international pressure. And, of course, they don't mind starving their people. That's a very bad combination all put together.
Oh, it's horrible. It's an absolutely horrible combination. I mean, this is one of those times... Well, who was it, President Kennedy, who said this is the day or the week that we earned our salary when he was talking about the missile crisis? This is a situation where there are no pretty options for President Trump, but he has to do something. I would support something drastic because North Korea is completely out of control. One more issue that I wanted to bring up this week, Bill, and that is the possibility that Justice Kennedy could be retiring. And that, of course, means another opening in the Supreme Court and another summer into fall of just some of the worst political madness that we can ever see. Because any time there's a Supreme Court nominee, look what happened with Mr. Gorsuch, and it would be even more, I think, with Mr. Kennedy, because he's seen by many as a tiebreaker kind of guy. I think it's going to be madness if that's what happens, Bill. I mean, to have a debate about a new nominee. I mean, we're going to hear things from the left that we haven't heard, I guess, maybe since, who was it, Mr. Bork was nominated in 87,
yes,
Bill?
Yes, that's right. Yes, that we will have a re-Borking because Gorsuch was such an outstanding nominee that no matter what they tried, it didn't work. But, you know, if Trump were to select, you know, a more typical nominee or perhaps a woman that would make them completely hysterical if he selected a Republican woman, because they don't believe that any woman can be a Republican, and they will wonder, you know, is this really a trans person in disguise trying to get a nomination? I think you're absolutely right. The Democrats will go completely berserk. I can just see a long hot summer over a Supreme Court nomination. I mean, have you ever seen a riot over a Supreme Court nomination? But you might have one, because they are. This is not only the Supreme Court. This is the Democratic Party's court of last resort. What the Democratic Party is involved in right now is losing. They keep on losing elections. They have lost 1,000 legislative seats. They really can't get anything done except through the technique of lawfare. Lawfare, and that is what they do. They go to investigations, they go to court decisions, they try to find a friendly judge out in Hawaii somewhere, or maybe living under a rock in New Mexico,
they can get a
decision, and that's the way they govern. So if they see the court just slipping away and slipping away and slipping away, they see their future slipping away, because who's going to be nice to them? You know?
Well, and there's another part of the story too, Bill, and that if in fact Mr. Kennedy were to go, or to resign or to retire, actually, and let's say he was replaced by another conservative, there is also a very likely possibility that in the next, I mean, I'm not wishing bad health on Justice Ginsburg, but she's not in good health. I always thought she was going to be the one who was going to retire because the lady is getting, she's in very bad health. So let's say she passes away, for example. That would mean that's three nominations in 2 years. That will really drive him crazy, Bill.
Well, yes, and of course, what we look at there also is really very grim to look at it because Justice Kennedy may not resign. He may say, you know, I have a nice place to go every day, and they have nice coffee here, and I'd rather stay on. So this is all speculative, but this once again emphasizes to us the importance of controlling the United States Senate, because it is the Senate that ratifies Supreme Court justices. And if the Senate were to be taken over by the Democrats by even one vote, 51-49, I don't think you will ever get a single Democrat to vote for any Trump nominee to the Supreme Court, because that Democrat would be destroyed the next day by his own party. In other words, they will expect absolute unanimity, and they may get it. So whatever happens, and I think Anthony Kennedy may be taking this into consideration, whatever happens in terms of a new Supreme Court justice has to happen in the next year unless the Republicans go on and continue to control the Senate. But that is key right now.
I think you're exactly right. And, of course, Justice Kennedy was nominated by President Reagan in 1987.
That's right.
He was the one, I think the first was Bork and then there was somebody else, and then Justice
Ginsburg.
Kennedy was... Yeah, there was, and then came
the other Ginsburg, not Ruth Ginsburg.
That's right,
but,
not this one. Yeah,
Douglas
so
Ginsburg
Reagan had,
is his name. Yeah,
Reagan had three times to nominate, or three tries to get Justice Kennedy, who has been fairly decent, except that Supreme Court same sex marriage decision, where I thought that was atrocious. But other than that, I don't know enough about it to say. But I thought that decision was a really bad one for the country because it once again put judges in control of these very difficult issues that should be settled by legislatures. Well, Bill, another week, another chat with you. What a pleasure. I guess we just have a lot more to get into next week.
We will have plenty to get into next week. I think this is going to be, we don't know if it's going to be a historic week. Certainly on health care it will be a historic week. And by the way, tomorrow, if Justice Kennedy retires, he might very well announce it tomorrow morning. So it is something that we will be looking at very, very carefully.
And there's also a decision that I think the court will be issuing on the ban, you know, the ban on travel. That's right. And then there's a couple of other decisions, too, that we'll probably be talking about next week that may be coming out. But have a wonderful day, Bill. Have a wonderful evening. And if you run into Al Gore, tell him he's got an invitation to the show any Sunday he wants to join us.
I will. If I find him, I will certainly pass that on to him.
Pass that on to him. Tell him we'll take good care of him. We'll give him plenty of coffee and we'll treat him well. So thank you very much, Bill. As always, thank you for your time and thank you for the great work you do at Urgent Agenda.
Well, thank you, Silvio. Talk to you next week.
Thank you so much. Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Time always flies with Bill, so I just have enough time to say goodbye. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.